Chapter 27.
You lost a great interstice of time. The next thing you knew, you were staring at the shadowy bowels of a room, lit only by a soft yellow puddle of light, a bedside table lamp. Lamp. Sheets slippery and cool over you. For the first time in your life, when you tried to let yourself panic and generate an adrenaline spike, it did not work. That trigger had broken. After too many days of generating cortisol, your pituitary gland was taking an unsanctioned holiday somewhere far away from you, and all you could do was lie bewildered in these unfamiliar surrounds. Not so unfamiliar. After many long and stupid moments, you realized that you had been laid to rest in the white and gold confection of Ianthe's bed, with its chilly satin coverlet and the lilac flowers embroidered in silk floss on almost every inch of the bedclothes. You willed yourself into panic again, flailing against the mattress, and sputtered out dolefully.
"Lie back down," said the Princess of Ida.
She was standing before the windows. The amethysts dripping from her rapier's basket hilt flashed and glittered in the darkness. She had her left arm tucked behind her, and her feet arranged a hip's width apart, and her right arm extended before her, holding her sword. She was moving the sword into mechanical attitudes, blade pointed high, blade pointed low, wrist twisted to sweep the blade into position. You struggled to sit up. Your head felt as though someone had studded your skull with fine little spikes that stroked your brain with hooked barbs whenever you moved.
"I said lie down," said Ianthe. "You absolute madwoman," she added, without any particular emotion. "Can't believe I ate a whole bowl of nun. I should have made myself throw up."
The Princess of Ida sounded unlike herself. This was a more detached Ianthe. Ianthe as an arm pulled from the socket. Ianthe as a tooth torn from the root. Your head was so heavy. For a moment, it was as though you were back on the Erebos again, when you had been made of cotton wool and black fog. She changed form. The rapier came down low over her left side, swung slowly to cover the right, flicked up in a steel shimmer so that the tip of the sword pointed at the ceiling on guard, then to the left again, then swinging high to absorb an imagined blow to the head and shoulders. Parry positions, which you should have known but didn't. Ianthe was training in her nightgown, a grisly floor-length concoction of pale golden lace that made her long, limber body look like a green-veined mummy, and even you could tell that her movements were ungainly and belaboured. It took you a long time to say, "Augustine," and she answered, immediate, impatient, "Are you still awake?" "Yes. One might have hoped that your light dinner-time entertainment would have given me an extension, but not so much." You said feebly, "The saint of duty, Autus, can suck wards." Ianthe said something very coarse in response. Then she said, "So that's why you stopped sleeping. Well, if he wants to attack you while you are here, I tell you truthfully that I welcome that inferno. But sleep, Harry." You were very weak. You felt an exhaustion beyond tiredness, a drugged, unstable fatigue. When you laid your head back against Ianthe's pillow, you smelled the thin, putrefying off-apple smell from her bedside table. And you smelled her, and that scent was now familiar. It was the animal yearning for the familiar that undid you. You closed your eyes, and you were asleep. How long you slept, you did not know. You did not know what dawn of which day you woke to. The daytime lights filtered through the hangings of the four-poster bed with a warm whiteness a lemony warmth limning the naked paintings that festooned the walls. It felt as though you had slept for 100 years. The satin coverlet was cool against your arms, and you lay in Ianthe's bed insensate, comfortable. Gradually, you felt a heavy weight in a depression next to you. You rolled onto your side, suddenly and deeply frightened that you might see the bed's owner. Your sword had been laid atop the covers beside your body, on the eiderdown, the bone scabbard gleaming a dull grey in the imitation sunlight. This was, in every single way, a better thing to wake up to than the face of Ianthe, love my twin, also murder, Tridentarius. Then you heard breathing. It was with unexpected clarity of mind and soul that you pushed the eiderdown away and crawled to the end of the bed, and you found Ianthe before you, on the floor. She was belly down on one of the cream and gold rugs on the deep honey-coloured plush carpet, and all around her was a growing crimson mat of blood. She sprawled in a puddle of red as though it was her shadow. Her long hair tumbled over her face and shoulders like a veil, and she grunted hard through her teeth, breathing in long, terrible breaths like a dying animal. As you watched, a silent spectator on her mattress, she propped herself on her elbows and grasped the ruddy crimson blade of her trident knife in both hands, and she thrust it furiously into the intolerable seam of her right arm. Ianthe struck again and again. The wound kept healing over. The skin sewed itself back up even as she pulled the blade away. Blood coalesced around the seam in a serried row of teeth, of needles, and these she used to try to lever herself apart, but her elbow wobbled beneath her and she collapsed on the sodden carpet. She dropped the knife from nerveless fingers. She slapped that almost imperceptible seam, then again. Then she gave a low and broken moan and fell over onto her side, curled fetally inward. Your mind was clear. Your thoughts were warm and tidy, as though they had been put through the sonic cleaner. It was with very little trepidation that you dropped to your knees beside her. You rolled her onto her back, and she looked at you with terrified eyes, half blue, part brown, with fragments of lavender. Her mouth was an ugly twist, contemptuous of herself. You had seen that expression a million times in your mirror, but never on her. "Harrow," she said unsteadily. She was trembling. "You're a fool," you said. "How I crave your honeyed words," said Ianthe. Her mouth was almost purple from the pain. "How I love your tender compassion." This was rank hypocrisy, but you were too focused to care. You said, "It needs to come off all at once." "What? Get something to bite down on." She looked at you, her eyes a wild confusion of colours. She lay spread before you in her hideous buttercup nightgown, which was now a party-coloured mix of gold and pink and red, like a liver. After a moment, she nodded. She ripped a bloodied swatch of yellow lace from her skirt, and she compressed it into a tight cylinder and pressed it between her teeth. Her teeth were very white, and her tongue was wet and red. You raised yourself up on your knees, swaying a little, and you pictured her for what she really was, an exquisite conglomeration of bone beneath skin and meat, pocketed in the middle with soft treasures of parenchyma and muscle. When you placed your hands upon her ribs, you were able to see her skeleton as though she had shyly undressed herself for you, as though in the orange hues of the daytime light she'd sloughed capillaries and glands off the budding rose of her scapula. You saw the curve of her clavicle, bowed softly as the line of some drooping bellflower. It was so easy. Now that you had slept, everything was easy.
It was as though you had been walking in a lead casing, and now you were free. As before any difficult work, you prayed out loud. Prayed for the rock to go unrolled and for the closed eye and the stilled brain. Prayed for a woman you loved to assist you in disrobing a woman you did not, but whose bones you would sacramentally adore. You kneeled on her thighs and unsheathed a great shank of bone from your knuckles. Ianthe bucked, just the once, and you sharpened the edge to a translucent liquid thinness. With one cut, you took the arm. You scythed through the knob of ligament and scapula and removed the humerus. Ianthe screamed through her mouthful of lace. The blood came like a spring tide over your front, and you felt it soak through your clothes and trickle down your navel. You cauterized the meat all at once, pinching the vessels closed, reaching down to press your fingers against where the humeral head had been. Then you covered over the gap with spongiform bone to give you a platform to work on, and you spun her shoulder beneath your fingers and it squirmed at your touch. Ianthe's screams had subsided to ravenous whimpers. Her arm had to be her own. That was no difficulty. You coaxed fine webby strands of red marrow from the wing of bone that girdled her shoulder, and from that, from minute osteoblastic grit, from the maze-like netting of the bone that swaddled the sponge and the marrow, you remade her. The humerus was child's play, and you took genuine pleasure in socketing it into the lovely cup of the radius, the forked embrace of the ulna. Her trochlea you sculpted while holding your breath, easing it into its wet white housing. The hand was almost an indulgence. The skeleton recalled itself. You did not need to know so intimately the lover's knot of carpal bones, the long tooth of her lunate, the jutting promontory of her trapezium, nor did you need to know the arch of the distal phalange, the shaft, the base. The new bone sprang avidly to meet your fingers, as though you were lovers joining hands after a long time apart. Your role with the bones was more guide than artist. The artistry would come at this point, and you warned her. This will hurt. Ianthe rocked upward. You knew your limits. You had understood what to do with her body innately, and it was not what she wanted, but you thought it would suffice. You blistered the bone and tendons only where you thought it was necessary for range of motion. You bubbled nerves into that shining periosteum where nerves had never been before. Not a full compliment, but just enough. Bone would call to bone, and nerve would call to brain. When you trailed your fingers up that new trunk of electrified humerus, she almost spat out the chunk of lace. When you pressed your palm into her shoulder and plugged her in, she sobbed rhythmically beneath you. What was left at the end was not an arm. It was a construct, a sectioned skeleton, defleshed. When you sat down beside her, you were chilly with sweat and pleasantly tired, as though you had run a good distance. You watched as Ianthe took the saliva-sodden wad of nightgown from her teeth, and, as shaking, she raised her new arm up to the light. The warm electric lamplight made her naked arm bones an iridescent gold. The old arm lay on the carpet, abandoned and dead, looking a little sorry for itself. You said, "I didn't bother about the meat." Ianthe said wonderingly, "But I've got some feeling in it. Most of the nervous glands are in your elbow. Why, even, you have worked out that the literal healing process is dependent on your nerve fibres. But you don't, I lack entirely what you all have," you said, "and have had to work out a replacement. I watched and compared. In the beginning, I thought maybe I could implant the process in myself. But it's not just a matter of nerves, even if those signal the reconstruction. I thought, if I experienced enough pain, something might kick in to save me. It didn't.
She spread her rightmost finger bones wide, then back, experimentally making a fist.
You said, you will still need a mat of tissue or cartilage on the palmar bones to hold the sword. Think of it as a glove.
Ianthe rolled away from you, damp with drying blood. You watched as she stood before the amethyst-studded rapier she had left in its scabbard, and you watched her slide it out slowly, with a soft metallic sound that set your teeth on edge. You watched her web her skeleton hand with a neon pad of fat. Not your preference, but she had her own proclivities, and raised the sword behind her, gauging the new weight in an arm substantially lighter than the one on the floor, and close her eyes.
Lunge.
The arm answered. The movement was reactive, liquid, smooth. She cut a sweep before her, then flicked her naked wrist. Each action was clean. The sword was as light in her hand as the bones in her arm. Her body was not her body. It was strange to you how you could see no trace of idle Ianthe in the parry and the thrust. Instead, you saw a cavalier who had known from the cradle what life intended for him, and had a rapier placed in his hands not long after. You might have changed your clothes or washed the blood from your body. All your sister Lictor did was throw her nacreous white robe over her shoulders, where it settled like snow under an aurora. All she did was belt her rapier to her waist and slide the trident knife into the special scabbard across the hip, and point at you and say, I'll be back in 15 minutes. Do not leave the room. You were still weary and frightened, and Ianthe leaving reminded you how vulnerable you really were. But Ianthe did not heed your protests, nor did she take 15 minutes. You sat yourself back on the bed and pulled the covers up around your shoulders, and very slowly and surely, your heart rate returned to normal. It was fully 25 minutes before the door opened again. You coiled for flight, but it was, after all, just Ianthe. An Ianthe who had changed. She was a sorry sight. You had an artist's fondness for the right arm, but recognised the shocking juxtaposition of it, of the bloodless flesh and then the bloodless bone, that unexpected and violent nudity. Her yellow lace nightgown had dried to a crust of brown, and her hair had dried in patches of much the same colour, a sort of carroty stain at the temples and the ends. But the expression on her face was that of undressed release. It was the expression of an awed child watching their raised skeleton totter forward for the first time without falling. She was incandescent, softly luminous in a way that gave her bleached skin a creamy colour, and which made the death mask lines of her blank face animated and alive. Her eyes were blue again, with those mountainous flecks of sea-parted brown, and for the first time you thought how much she resembled her twin. She was still grasping her lovely third rapier in her skeleton hand, the blade naked to you, and she said, not bothering to hide her excitement,
Shit, it's going to break.
Not in a hurry, Tridentarius, that's regenerating ash. There wasn't the same weight behind my thrust.
He didn't compensate.
She swung her sword in a slow, glittering arc, revolving her wrist. Ianthe said, not unhumorously, Nibirius always compensated.
You asked, what did Augustine the First say?
Nothing, she said, and she started to laugh. Peals of bell-like laughter. She dropped to sit on the bed and exulted.
Nothing much. He dropped me into the river, went 2 rounds against my body. It worked, Nona Jesmus. It worked. He says it's hideous and he'll gild it for me.
Tacky, you said, but I can fight the same way I fought after I became a Lictor, before I lost the arm. I'm real. I work. Harry, I am a Lictor. Her jubilance was infectious. It did not hurt you. You were not a lictor. You said, "You may feel free to thank me any time you so choose." Ianthe was suddenly beside you on the bed. She had dropped her rapier among the bedclothes, and for the very first time brushed the dry distal tip of her new pointer finger against your cheek. You were vulnerable, but you did not pull away. She tapped you on the cheekbone, and once on the tip of your nose, and then lastly pressed her naked finger to your bottom lip. "Thank you," she said. "Harrow, you loved that." The smooth claw of the finger joint felt cool against your mouth. Her head was quite close to yours. The lace nightgown gapped somewhat at the front. The Princess of Ida said, "I already know how I'm going to thank you." And you were bemused. You absolute idiot baby, you were mystified. You were tired, and you were embarrassed, and you were riding high from the satisfaction of doing one half-perfect thing, of having committed a low miracle of your own devising, of, for a handful of minutes, being Harrowhark Nona Jesimus again, the greatest necromancer produced by your dark and sacred Dreaber. Ianthe took her finger from your lips, looked at you, and smiled a phosphorescent and confidential smile. She said, "I'm going to help you kill the Saint of Duty."